Hi, I'm Mick Kelly, and this is Food Done Right.
I literally just picked up the phone and I called the White House switchboard. I knew the name of Michelle Obama's policy director, and I just asked to be put through to that person. She was definitely a bit surprised.
Yeah.
I remember her saying, "This is very bold of you, but I appreciate your boldness. I was just giving this message. If I can plant a White House garden, so can you, future president of the United States."
The stuff grew so high that it was difficult to steer the boat because you're looking down the length of this boat and then there are all these really tall plants. So I did spend the summer perched on the side of the boat, looking around the side of these plants to be able to steer with the tiller.
Growing food completely changed the course of history. Somewhere along the way, we've become entirely removed from where our food comes from. But if we grow food, reconnect, and care about our food, we can change the future's course.
Between the 1960s and 1990s, South Korea transformed from a relatively poor country to a wealthy one. For almost every country that has this experience, the shift comes with a move from wholesome traditional diets to the high-fat, high-sugar, highly processed Western diet. But this country took a different path, and vegetable consumption actually increased. Because South Korea does not just count rice as a staple food, it also counts a spicy, fermented cabbage dish called kimchi. It's one little example of food done right. My name is Barry Flynn, and alongside me is GIY's founder and hacker grower-in-chief, Mick Kelly. How's it going there, Mick?
It's going well, Baz.
Are you a kimchi fan yourself?
I am a... No, not really. I'm more of a sauerkraut fan, I think. And appropriately enough, we're sitting in the larder today. It was the only place we could find that wasn't rammed with people. And so there's lots of jars of interesting things around us here. But yeah, I'm more of a sauerkraut fan. I kind of got into it about been growing cabbage kind of on and off for years, and it's an obvious thing to make a bit of sauerkraut from your cabbage. And I find over time I've kind of got addicted to it. Like I don't know, is it like a physical thing that your body kind of craves after a while or whatever, but I absolutely love it. And the kids and my wife absolutely hate it because it's like as soon as you pop open that jar, you know, the stink of cabbage in the room. But I just absolutely love it. And it kind of, I think it's a great metaphor for like with everything with growing your own food. At the start, I was kind of a bit afraid of it, you know, like, will I poison myself and will I poison my family? But like, you know, you just get more confident with it. And now I just absolutely love the taste of it.
Start to enjoy all that good bacteria in the gut.
There you go.
So it strikes me that maybe you weren't always eating sauerkraut. You probably didn't grow up on a sauerkraut diet, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, that sounds like it would be a bit unusual for a man growing up in Meath and
That's
Waterford.
True.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up, you know, surrounded by all these pickles and chutneys and eating sauerkraut, all these unconventional food behaviours? You know, we know the GIY story all began in a supermarket, spotting a bulb of garlic from China, mm-hmm. deciding enough is enough. I'm going to go and I'm going to grow this garlic myself. But then what happened?
Yeah, that's part of the story I almost never tell, I guess. But nothing happened very quickly. It's very slow, as with a lot of other things with growing your own food. And so the garlic kind of, I was worried after, in my moment of sort of post garlic epiphany, peek out in the garden, digging holes, shoving the garlic in there. And then, of course, nothing happened for ages. And then, you know, eventually a little shoot comes out of the bare soil and you're feeling pretty happy with yourself. But in the end, like garlic is one of these weird things where it actually, it grew and the stalk is there in the ground. And I knew so little about food growing that actually I think I was probably thinking about the ornamental alliums or something where the sort of bulb forms at the top of the stalk. And I was I was thinking, will the garlic grow up there, you know, like a foot and a half off the ground or whatever? And will it be flapping around in the wind? And is it not too heavy? And will that not like fall over? But then...
Was this before Google?
This is before Google, yeah. So like... I was kind of waiting for this thing to happen and then nothing happened. It didn't turn into a bulb of garlic above the ground. And then when garlic is ready to be eaten, it actually, the stalk, the stem goes brown and kind of collapses and falls over. And so I just thought it was dead because there was no garlic to be seen anywhere. So then I got out a shovel or something from the garage and went to dig this thing out to throw it away, like thinking the grand garlic experiment had completely failed. And there was this like magnificent bulb of garlic underneath the ground. And like in my head, looking back at it, it was like the size of an orange. But, you know, I was so chuffed with myself. And actually, you know, that movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, and he's like, he gets fire. He's trying to light a fire for weeks, like, and eventually he gets it, and he's jumping around on the beach bare chested. Like, that's what I was like in the garden. You know?
Wilson!
I thought I was like Monty Don. I was just so delighted with myself. And it like, It hooked me. Like, I was smitten from absolute day one that you could produce this food in your own backyard, you know.
And how did you get from there to, you know, preserving massive batches of cabbages and other vegetables into a year-round supply of kraut?
Yeah, like, that's a great question. I think slowly is probably the answer. Like, it just it's gradual, you know. It's 15 years later. I think every year you learn a little bit, you do a little bit more. And you try a bit more, and you things go wrong, and you make a mess of them, and then other times things go right, and it's great, and you just learn gradually. And the more confidence you get, then the more you're willing to try things like sauerkraut, you know, and having this amazing thing stored away for the winter months.
And why do you think that's so important?
Well, you know, I think that one of the big things for me that just, I suppose, was part of that, like, think about to that garlic moment in the supermarket where you're buying this Chinese bulb of garlic and then you're trying to grow it and you don't know where the bloody bulb grows on, you know, you just know nothing, I think is a great metaphor for how completely and utterly disconnected we are from our foods, from where our food comes from and from the food system. And so it's like, It's what struck me about the Chinese garlic, the thing that sort of, like, not quite outraged me, but just that I could not get my head around, was how does it make sense to, you know, for a poor Chinese farmer somewhere to grow this thing and then ship it halfway across the world and then have it for sale in a supermarket in Waterford for, like, you know, 50 cent or whatever, or a euro.
Yeah.
It seems so illogical and stupid, you know. And so, like, for all of the problems in the food system, and I think there are loads. And while in some sense, like, it's a logistical marvel, and it's incredibly miraculous in some ways that we have this food available all year round and so on, it's also, I think, deeply flawed and practically broken in other ways. So, like, we've got the food system causing a third of global greenhouse gas emissions or whatever. So it's right up there with transport and energy in terms of the big picture climate change problems. Yeah. But for me, it's just that general sense of kind of disconnection from our food that is the big problem, and particularly seasons. So, like, you know, when you eventually get your garlic or you get your cabbage out of the ground, you make kimchi, and you're reconnecting with this, the sort of the arc of the seasons through the year. And I think that's just a miraculous thing that for me has been the biggest change, like just reconnecting with seasonal eating and with where my food comes from has just been life changing.
Mm. Yeah, it feels like we're following the laws of economics as opposed to the laws of nature or common sense or culture or history or all of these things. And during this series, we're going to examine these problems in the food system throughout our daily life. So we're going to look at home, at school, in the community, at work, going out and in care. And we're going to start today with the home, where obviously most food is eaten. And we're going to take a look at life in America.
Yeah, well, I think America is the problems with our food system writ large, you know, and the Western diet that you talk about, which is, I've heard it described as SAD crap, which is an acronym for Standard American Diet Carbohydrates Refined and Processed, which I always think is brilliant. I'm glad I could remember that as well. Yeah. But like it's. Yeah, all of those problems just on a vast scale and obviously where they came from in the first instance in many cases. So, like, we all know it's that kind of fast food nation sort of view that we have about America that so little time is spent preparing meals and cleaning up. I think on average 30 minutes a day or something like that, 20% of meals eaten in cars, you know, it's just an absolute mess as a food system. And so it seemed like a brilliant place for us to start.
Yeah, and I mean, I think so much of that is about the economic disparity in the US that is also so great, that I think drives a lot of those negative food outcomes that forces people to have those meals in cars and everything else. But there's also a peculiar middle class aspect to life in the US that's interesting for us to highlight, and another little disconnection from nature, and that is lawns. So, you know, we did a little bit of research on this before the show and came across an interesting article. It was actually citing a NASA study from 2005 that showed that 2% of the continental United States is back garden lawns, which might not sound like a huge amount, you know, in the context of the whole country, but it translates to an area of land 10 times the size of Ireland. Obviously, Ireland, you know, a renowned agricultural powerhouse. But, you know, all of those Americans just sitting on all of that underutilized space. And that's something that we're going to kind of take a little bit of a peek at today as well.
Yeah, and probably sitting on their ride-on mowers as well and driving around. Like, I even feel that with my own garden at home. Like, mowing a lawn is such a waste of time, isn't it? It's like, it's just the deadest time. Like, you're literally not doing anything and you're using fossil fuels in the process to do it. Like, so we came across a guy a long time ago, I think probably 9 years ago. We invited him to come over to one of the original GIY gatherings that we used to have, kind of like a festival once a year. And our first guest today is a guy called Roger Dworn, who came over to one of those original events. And he's an amazing character. And I think what interests me about Roger is that he kind of looks on that, all of that lawn space, all of that dead space, as an incredible asset that can be unlocked if we turn those lawns, or at least part of them, into spaces where we grow their own food. And he did something pretty incredible about it. Instead of just like having his garlic epiphany like I did, he decided to ring up the White House and try and get the incoming Obama administration to turn that into the White House, which is probably the most famous lawn of all. Turned that into a food growing space, and successfully did so, famously. So Roger started out by taking me back to the very beginning of the White House garden story.
Well, a lot of things sort of fell into place at the right time. It's one of those cases where the planets sort of aligned in terms of the right message being delivered at the right time to the right person. And I'll only take a small part of the credit, because ultimately it was Michelle Obama who was the visionary who could see just how impactful such a garden could be. And she was the one who took the big risk of actually going out there with a bunch of fifth graders and some garden tools and ripping up, you know, a very historic White House lawn without knowing necessarily how the American public would take it. But just to quickly go back in time. So, yes, this was 2008. And I was in a very fortunate situation in that I had just received a 2-year fellowship that gave me a great amount of freedom with which to spend my time, essentially. So the only stipulation was that I needed to do work that was related to what is called food systems change, and that ideally that work would result in media coverage. And because gardening was my thing, I was looking to get media coverage for vegetable gardening, home gardening. And I just saw this opportunity in 2008, because the American presidential election is sort of this crazy thing which takes months and months. And I saw all of this attention that was being drawn to the candidates who were crisscrossing Iowa. And I said to myself, how could we sort of inject garden politics into presidential politics? And so what sort of happened after that was just a series of fortunate events, you might say, in that I saw an opportunity to get the issue entered as a contest idea with the United Nations Foundation. They were looking for the best idea for the next president to take on upon taking office. And I proposed the idea of digging a vegetable garden. And at that time, my nonprofit organization just had a few thousand email subscribers, but I was able to get essentially every single one of them to vote for our idea in the contest. And so we were able to sort of propel this idea to the top of this list, which then resulted in some media coverage. And then we put up a Facebook petition. And then we put together some videos that went sort of semi-viral. You mentioned, Mick, about, you know, me using my own garden. It just so happens that I live in a white house of my own. It's a little,
nice,
little white house, not all the grandeur of the White House. But my wife and I just filmed the digging of our White House garden, and I put it to some sort of classic American music, and was just giving this message: if I can plant a White House garden, so can you, future President of the United States. And then there were some little gimmicks along the way. For example, we symbolically put the White House lawn up for sale on eBay in 1 square foot parcels. That sale stayed up on eBay for all of, I think, 2 days before somebody realized that you can't actually sell the White House lawn. but the point of that was, this is our lawn. We're the owners of that lawn, essentially. And we get to decide how it's used. So this would have been in January or so of 2009. So this was as the Obamas were moving into the White House. We'd had all of this media coverage, like in 500 different newspapers across the country. And I was sort of struggling, saying to myself, we've had all this coverage, but I still don't know whether anyone important has actually seen any of this. And so I literally just picked up the phone and I called the White House switchboard. And I had done a little bit of research. It was terribly naive, but also effective in the end, in that I knew the name of Michelle Obama's policy director, and I just asked to be put through to that person. And this was well before they had their firewalls in place to prevent people like me from actually getting to talk with anybody important. And so I was just put through right away to the policy director.
You got through to the right person, like from a cold call. That is incredible.
Yeah. So she was definitely a bit surprised.
Yeah.
I remember her saying, this is very bold of you, but I appreciate your boldness. And so I said, I don't know. Have you guys noticed all of the excitement and energy around this idea of having, you know, future First Lady Michelle Obama plant a garden at the White House? And she said, oh, no, we're very much aware of it. So, you know, let's see. let's be in touch again and to see where we can sort of go with this. So I ended up having another conversation with a lower level policy person, where they were asking me some questions about sort of what I had heard from having run this campaign for a number of months that might sort of give some pause to them.
Yeah.
For example, was there something, some sort of political downside that I had heard about that they ought to know about, for example? And I quite frankly said no, that that's the amazing thing about vegetable gardens, is that they're not conservative, they're not liberal, they really, you know, cut across politics. And I really felt that this garden would have the broad support of the American people if Michelle Obama were to plant it.
Roger, looking from a kind of an internationalist perspective into it, the garden was kind of foundational to a lot of the kind of campaigning work Michelle Obama did about kind of wellness. She came under a lot of pressure from sort of the big ag industry about promoting organic growing and so on. So it felt like, and I know you've used that word subversive before, which I think is like you felt your own plot was subversive. But did you feel like the White House garden was a subversive thing, or was it written off as kind of, you know, the privileged elite sort of having their nice hobby? That's one of the challenges we always find in DIY. I think that you're trying to combat that sense of food growing being just a nice middle class hobby, that like it is something much more profound and subversive than that.
Well, I do think the White House garden was subversive in the sense that it wasn't just a garden for the Obamas, and it wasn't just a garden for the elite people who happened to be able to enjoy a meal served at the White House, but that it was a garden sort of for the people. Michelle Obama always made a point of ensuring that whenever there was work to be done during the planting of the garden or the harvesting of the garden, she would invite young people from the Washington, D.C. area to help her do that. And so I think it was giving this important message, which is that good food is for everyone, and it's not just for the elite. And the symbolism of doing that on the White House lawn just cannot be sort of overstated, I think, because it was, and I think continues to be, the most publicized lawn in the world. And so the decision to use up some of that for that purpose was, I think, really quite important. And as you mentioned, Mick, she did an excellent job of using the garden as sort of a platform or a stage for talking about much bigger issues simply than gardening, such as the health of our young people, for example, equity, these really big topics. I think gardeners have an important role in, and to the extent that we can get out of our own backyard gardens and get into sort of the public space more when it comes to food issues, I think that that's actually a very positive development.
I was watching your TED talk, and again, one of the things I love about the way you speak about food growing, the idea of the subversive plot, but also that sense that, this can have a huge impact if it's done at scale. And one of the things I think DIY and your own organization share is that scale ambition, right? What do you think is the real potential for food growing if it was done at scale?
Well, I think the impacts could be huge in terms of the impacts on health, the impacts on climate, the impacts on well-being. As a gardener yourself, the feeling of well-being that you get from spending an hour in your own garden, connecting to the earth, using your body, feeling your body, maybe feeling it a little bit too much at the end of that day. I think one of the things that I keep coming back to, and I'm sure you do as well with gardening, is that there is this feeling of a satisfaction that comes with being able to do something tangible. These issues like climate change, they're just so big and they seem overwhelming. And it seems like it's really hard to do anything that actually moves the needle whatsoever. And so I sort of have this little quote up on my computer screen, which is, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something.
Yeah.
And I kind of keep coming back to that. And so when you're growing a little plot in your backyard, or when a school is planting a school garden, or when a community group is putting in a community garden in a blighted area in a city, whether it's in Ireland or in the United States, they're doing something. They're taking some sort of tangible action, saying, I don't have a lot of power, but darn it, I'm going to use the power I have. I'm going to do something with what I have in terms of my time, my resources, my space. And I think that that's a very uplifting message. One thing that has come to my attention in the different talks I've given is that, people say, does it really matter, this little act that I'm taking? And I continue to emphasize that indeed it does, because all of these acts add up in the end, And so that's why it's so important to bring more people, new people, into the gardening movement, because all those little gardens add up to something quite consequential in the end.
One of the thoughts I had, though, to ask you was, like, the contrast between what the White House sort of plot and your own plot represent as a type of food system, and then the reality of what the US food system is like. Can you speak a bit about that kind of contrast? Because I guess, like, you could look at the White House garden and think everybody in America is kind of doing something similar, but the reality is much different than that, I think, isn't it?
Oh, it is, of course, yes. So in my TED talk, I included a couple of slides where I showed an image of what the White House garden layout looked like at the time of planting, with this incredible diversity of crops, these very healthful crops, leafy greens, salads, you name it. And then I transposed onto that that same layout of the White House garden, what the U.S. agricultural policy would look like if it were sort of in that same garden space. And essentially all you see are things like soybeans, corn, cotton, wheat. And so the focus of U.S. agricultural policy continues to be these sort of industrialized grains, things that are essentially meant to make sure that food is very cheap, but that also the quality is not particularly good. So there's definitely a disconnect there. But I think that to the extent that we get more people growing vegetables, obviously you'll see more people eating vegetables too. And we need to certainly redirect our policies, whether it's in the United States or the European Union, to put more emphasis on producing the healthy stuff as opposed to the less healthy stuff. So that disconnect is still there. The White House garden was not a magic wand in terms of suddenly changing dramatically the way that U.S. agricultural policy sort of played itself out.
But I think it's so interesting as a model, though, for what a kind of alternative food system could look like. And I always think one of the things I think is just the great hope for me is that this planet healthy diet, like the diet that we know to be, you know, healthy for human beings and healthy for the planet, which involves way more fruit and vegetables, as you say, and much less meat and less grains and so on, is the diet that food growers, I think, gravitate towards anyway.
That's definitely the case. You know, I always tell people that the garden tells me what's for dinner tonight. and I build a lot of meals around what happens to be available. So, you know, here in New England, at this time of the year, we're looking at, you know, the last crops of the year, we're looking at a lot of cabbage crops, the last of the salad greens, the root vegetables, and then of course the different things that we've preserved. But it's a very healthy way of eating when you build your meals around the vegetables that you have available, as opposed to, you know, maybe starting in the meat section of the grocery store and thinking in terms of what vegetables can I add to this plate to sort of balance it out a little bit more. It's a complete paradigm shift, you might say, when you put vegetables first and think about what else you might serve to sort of go with those vegetables.
Much more challenging situation in the kitchen, but a lot more fun, I think, as well. I think you're right. I think, and I guess that when you follow the seasons the way you're suggesting, it's the healthiest, it's the most sustainable, and it's also delicious because it's so fresh and straight out of the ground. You know, Dan Barber talks about the carroty carrot. When you eat food that's just out of the ground, it just tastes totally different, doesn't it?
It does, for sure. Yeah, there's just this sort of vibrant, alive quality to the foods that have, you know, just been harvested from the garden. They haven't traveled across the country as is often the case here in the United States. That's one of the reasons that with my organization, Seed Money, we're focusing so much these days on public food gardens, trying to make sure that the people who don't have access to their own yard, for example, can still, you know, grow some healthy foods by having access to some space, you know, somewhere within their community.
That's really, really interesting, because I was going to ask you, when you came to Waterford 9 years ago, it was Kitchen Gardens International, and then it's become Seed Money in the meantime, and as you say, focusing on funding community growing projects. Was that because you felt the biggest challenge was access to growing space, or was it that, you know, you felt food growing is best done in the community as opposed to sort of isolated at home by yourself, or what was behind that change?
Well, it was the result of quite a bit of reflection and a fair amount of research too, in that we had been doing some surveys of our membership back when we were called Kitchen Gardeners International, and we were asking, you know, people on the ground, what do you think we ought to be doing? You know, we have some ideas about what we think we should do, but what do you think we should do? And what we kept on hearing more and more of was, we'd like to see more gardens planted in our community, more public gardens, so school gardens, community gardens, food bank gardens, gardens behind senior homes, gardens associated with juvenile detention centers. And so we decided to sort of move into that space just because we obviously continue to believe really strongly in home growing. That's why I do it myself and why I love it so much. And so that is certainly, still really important to be done. But I started to think more, I guess, about this question about accessibility and how we could sort of grow the garden movement by thinking in terms of who's not invited to the table at this point and how do we invite them. And so that was sort of the reason behind sort of this shift to public food gardens as opposed to, private backyard gardens.
And the scale of it, I think, is pretty amazing. Like, I think 1,600 projects I read on your website that you've supported, which is incredible. But any of them jump out for you in terms of any favorites?
Yeah, it's like saying which is my favorite son of my three. Yes. There is actually a project that continues to sort of amaze me and inspire me each year. It's actually a prison garden project from Rhode Island that we're very happy to give a grant to every year. And it's just so moving to see the photos of these men who are sort of rediscovering their own dignity by growing food and feeling like they're able to do something good. There's like a sense of redemption, I think, on their part. And they're actually preparing for their lives after prison as well. So that's a particularly moving project. And it does remind me of something I read a number of years back about Nelson Mandela during his many years of incarceration. He too found a lot of peace in the garden.
Yeah.
And so there's something quite powerful about that, I think.
That's very cool. I think we did a couple of projects in Ireland which that resonates with. Like there's an open prison in Cavan that we worked with, and also there's a system of housing migrants in Ireland or asylum seekers in Ireland called direct provision centres, which is really awful. But we've seen supported some gardens getting established there, and again, people in absolutely dire situations, the most basic thing we can do is feed ourselves. Like they have that taken away from them in these centers, and just seeing gardens giving, as you say, empowering people and giving back that sense of purpose and reconnecting with them with something really fundamental in life. Roger, I have to ask you before we finish up, as Europeans, we sort of watched through our fingers over the last 4 years as the Trump administration sort of demolished many an international norm. But without getting into the politics of it, I suppose, did the White House kitchen garden, do we know, did it survive Donald Trump or what? Where is it at now?
It's alive and well. And once again, First Lady Michelle Obama gets all the credit because she had such foresight that she thought ahead of time to sort of understand what would be the potential threats to the garden. And so one threat that she anticipated was that there would be people who would say, oh, we can't maintain this garden because it's going to be too expensive to maintain. So before leaving office, she raised a lot of money and basically created a sort of an endowment. Wow. To make sure that no one could use that argument against the garden. But perhaps more importantly, she hardscaped the garden by putting in these large stones, that these massive, heavy stones that would have required some very heavy machinery to remove. So yes, the garden is alive and well. It's being maintained by the White House kitchen staff and the ground staff, and it's still doing all of those amazing things in terms of providing vegetables for not just the White House but also the greater DC community.
That's brilliant. I was worried. I saw a picture of a new tennis court and tennis pavilion, I think, in the garden. I was worried it had been tarmacked over or something. So that's very good to know that the food garden sort of transcends politics. Roger, as always, I'm so inspired by your work, and it's been way too long, so it's been brilliant to reconnect, and it just continued success to you and all your team doing what you do, fighting the good fight, and keep running that subversive plot.
Well, it's what I do, and right back at you, Mick, for all the great work you and GIY are doing as well.
So I just love that idea of the subversive plot that Roger talks about. It's just class. Like, I think we should steal that, Baz, and use that ourselves. You'll see that in GIY press releases in the months ahead. You know, one of the things, though, that strikes me, like, for all the, like, just the brilliance of that story about getting the White House to grow their own food and then, you know, multiplying that out across America, you do kind of think about American kind of gardens as being like big spaces, whereas I guess, you know, that's not always going to be the case. And like, we have to keep food growing kind of accessible to everyone, whether you've got sort of much space or not, really, don't you?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm obviously newer to the food growing game than you are, Mick. But, you know, I've learned myself in the last couple of years that there is a bit of a misconception about how much space you need, you know, and just how valuable even a small space is, you know. I've been growing tomatoes in a bedroom, you know, the last couple of years, growing chilies on a windowsill. And, you know, even if you're not going to feed your whole family for the year, there's still so much to gain from that, you know, so much just sort of pride and pleasure to take from it. And I think that's sort of the moral of the story for our next guest, who is kind of taking it to the next level a little bit, in that she has set up her subversive plot on a floating rooftop somewhere around Tyknevin in Kildare. So, you know, if you can grow food on top of a houseboat along the inland waterways of Ireland, then there's no stopping you. So let's go ahead and meet Erin Fornoff, a GIY supporter from the very early days. She helped to raise funds for the upstart GIY movement over 10 years ago. Now she's a full-time writer and poet and mother, and she continues to spread the GIY word from her houseboat rooftop garden. Erin, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Barry.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about your earliest experiences growing food back home in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina?
My mother was always a brilliant gardener and had beautiful flowers. And then I worked on just an Appalachian farm for a summer, mostly in their massive garden. And so there was this older lady who'd lived her entire life in this farmhouse who used to just go out with me and give me just this education on you know, on how to grow things, and particularly how to grow things in an organic way. And it just, you know, I loved it. And it was so peaceful. And, you know, you work so hard and it's so peaceful. And then when stuff actually fruits and flowers, then it was just deeply satisfying, even for like a pretty cynical 19-year-old, I guess. But it just kind of sparked something, I guess. Planted a seed, you could say.
So when you left home for college, you know, you began a bit of an odyssey where gardens effectively fill the role of home, you know, pretty much wherever you went. So can you tell us about your first kind of home away from home garden experience in college?
Yeah, I went to a huge university with about, I think there were about 25,000 undergraduate students. And I just, you know, was looking for kind of my tribe. And I grew up with lots of, you know, kind of nice hippies, you know, like very capable people. And I was just kind of looking for that. So I ended up starting the Carolina Garden Co-op. It was like a teaching garden. So it was a community garden, but less focused on getting lots of stuff for people to eat out of it. Because the one challenge with a college garden is that everyone's away for the summer when all the good stuff comes in. So it was more a way where people could go and, you know, be a part of this garden, but learn how to do things that they could get, then go back and do on their own. And I scouted the whole university looking for pieces of land to put it. And they just told me no, 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 every time. And I finally found this like vacant big piece of grass and looked in the tax records in the public library to figure out who owned it. And then I just like called them over and over again until they let me put a garden there and ended up starting that garden on like the worst drought in recorded history. And we got water from like a university building across the street. So we had to like sneak in at midnight to water the garden because there were all these drought rules. But it was great. And, you know, we had like t-shirts and lots of members, and we'd have garden days and people come in and talk to the garden. And I realized that if, you know, you send out emails to say, oh, there's a work day in the garden. And I realized if I sent out an email that was like, hey, come and work in the garden or garden day tomorrow, you get people showing up. But if you send out an email that says XXX hot garden action XXX, then you get loads of people showing up for work days then.
So many more capable hippies coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a useful tip for DIY there.
How to recruit capable hippies. Yeah, that's fantastic. So when you moved to Dublin then about 10 years ago, and you know, you continued your work finding and supporting social entrepreneurs like Mick, but again, you turned to community garden projects to kind of settle in and feel at home. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was like lonely. It was lonely to move to a new country. And so I was kind of up for doing lots of different things and meeting people. And there was something, I can't remember who kicked this off. It may have been some kind of political stunt or something, but it was a guerrilla gardening initiative where people descended upon this empty piece of land near Booterstown Dart Station and just put in a little garden. And it wasn't vegetables. It was mostly just flowers and like bedding plants and stuff. But it was just a day to take this ugly piece of land and make it a pretty piece of land. So I went to that and it was fun. And I met this guy, Owen, who became my first friend in Ireland. And then from there, we ended up starting this project that was a rooftop garden on Sundial House, which is it's run through DePaul, and it's a wet shelter for street drinkers. And it's this sort of state-of-the-art shelter. And the residents there are permanent residents. So they have their own rooms, and they usually, you know, they're like late stage alcoholics. So they kind of make a drinking plan with the staff. And it could be, you know, it's pretty bleak. It's like, I will only drink 2 bottles of vodka a day. And so they get like a distribution of alcohol every few hours. And there's a nurse on call and a canteen and stuff. But they have this gorgeous roof area. So we just started working with the residents to build this rooftop garden. And, you know, like we're carrying railroad sleepers up 5 flights of stairs and hauling all this dirt up to the roof. But it just became something so lovely. And gardening, you know, it's really good for all kinds of people, because you don't really need to be fluent in the same language. You don't need to be able to read, because a lot of those guys couldn't read or they had brain damage from drinking and so on. And you can also do it while you're drunk. And a lot of those guys either grew up out in the middle of the nowhere in a rural kind of area, so would have had some experience with growing, or they worked with things like landscapers. Or, you know, there's one guy who used to, you know, those hanging flower baskets that go over the old school pubs, like he used to make those. So there was a lot that people could do, even if they had limited capacities otherwise. But it did just like develop into this stunning space. You know, we had about 50 canes of raspberry and lettuces and cabbages and spuds and a bunch of stacked up tires and, you know, sweet pea all the way around like the fences, and just loads of different vegetables, and then hanging baskets over the walls of the space. And, you know, you could see it driving up Thomas Street, which was so exciting. And the residents started spending a lot of time there. And even the directors of the place started having their like funder meetings up there. And it was really lovely. And that place was pretty bleak, and people were, you know, in a difficult spot. And honestly, like all of the people I worked with on that garden have since passed away. Because a lot of them are very close to, you know, when you're a late stage street drinker, alcoholic, like you're very close to death, even when you're in a nice place with a warm bed and a nurse on call. But it was just, and it was lovely. And I think that's something about gardening that always attracted me, is it's, and it attracts a lot of people, is it's something that's like visually positive. Like it's a hopeful thing. And I wonder if that's why people like community gardens and murals so much, because it's just this visually positive thing. And it was like a source of achievement. You know, part of why I moved away from working on that project was that they kind of just started doing it themselves. You know, like I'd come for the workday and they would have like planted up all the flowers already. And I'd be like, oh, okay, great. You know, but also at the same time, that sounds like you don't even need me anymore.
Nice. The kind of the community garden journey of yours. So between, you know, college and then in Dublin, I guess it had to come to an end at some point for yourself, because, you know, you found a place to call home. But of course, sure enough, that place is a home on water. It's a houseboat. And your kind of adventure spirit of finding gardens is obviously alive and well. I've seen you tweet at Mick and call him responsible for your addiction to growing, which feels like a little bit rich given that you've been doing it for so long. But it does suggest that he might have played some kind of role in enabling this floating rooftop garden in and around Tichnevin in Kildare at the moment. So can you tell us a bit about, you know, Mick and DIY and anything that you know, he or the organization has done to help you on this journey?
You know how they talk about like Instagram influencers, you know, like put up all these pictures of themselves in like private jets, designer clothes, like Mick's like the version of that, but with parsnips, you know? Also, he wrote this book called Grow, Cook, Eat. That's both a cookbook and kind of a really beautiful guide for how to grow food in Ireland. And he gave me a copy of that book. And that's really what I've gone to as a lesson for how, what to grow when and what grows well in Ireland. Because like the stuff from North Carolina, some of the things you learn in North Carolina don't really apply here. You know, at home they say like corn should be knee high by the 4th of July. And, you know, that's not a thing over here and with a different weather and so on. But I really went to his book as a guide for the kind of things that would grow here and when to start growing them, which was really, it's really handy. It's a great book.
So, Erin, I think that takes us to, you know, the business end of things, right? So, you know, one of the reasons we wanted you to come on the show was to help other people who are starting gardens at home, you know, with some advice of your own. And, you know, at GOI, you know, we're all about encouraging people to grow some of their own food, no matter what space they have. And you've managed to build a garden on a houseboat, of all places. So surely if you can do it, then there's no excuses for anyone else. So can you give us a little bit of a kind of, you know, mini masterclass in how you set up your rooftop garden, and maybe some people can listen in and figure out how to do the same.
Yeah, so our boat is 55 feet long and 7 feet wide. And one thing it has as a benefit for gardening is that you can move to get the best sun. So you can kind of chase the sunlight. So we did gardening on the roof for the past 2 years, and we did it different each time. But the first time we had a big storage box on the roof that was about maybe 4 feet long and 3 feet wide. Just a box with slats on the bottom. And we got bags of compost, just the ones that you would get at Woody's, and put those in there. And then had a few random little pots for herbs. How do you guys say it? Herbs.
Herbs. There's a H in it.
And, you know, and some little flower things. Just three of those in a row, and then cut a big square out of one of them and planted it really heavily with spinach and lettuces and chard. You know, if you plant lettuces and stuff really close together like that, it kind of grows into like baby lettuce leaves, and the tightness keeps some of the bugs from going away. But you have to thin it out, which I didn't do enough of that year. And then we planted mange tout and French beans. Oh, and we had leeks in there. And then we also had a courgette plant. We could just produce so much out of that little space. Tons of mange tout, tons of beans. We had like salad all summer, tons of chard, about 20 leeks. I mean, Americans don't even know what a leek is really, but like I had to use Mixbook to look up recipes for leeks because I was like, what am I supposed to do with this little leek? And then just like a truly ludicrous amount of courgettes. And courgettes, when they go well, like those plants are just ridiculous. Like there used to be these cartoons in the paper in the US about how the courgette plants were so overabundant that people would just pile a bunch of courgettes on their neighbor's front door and ring the bell and run away. That's like to get rid of the courgettes. So like we had so many courgettes and we'd go through the locks, you know, the canal has the locks and they're these lock keepers who sometimes help you, you know, fill up the chamber or let the chamber down. So we'd hand them bags of produce sometimes, which I hope they like some people hand them like a can of Guinness or something, you know, or €5.
Using the bags of compost that the way you did, like that's just sort of, I'm having like a moment now thinking about all the times that I have like emptied bags of compost into other containers to create containers. And you were just like, no, I've got everything I need right here.
Yeah, it's great because it, and you cut, you know, you cut holes in the bottom so they can drain. But, and if you're doing something like planting lettuces close together, you cut a square out of the top. But for stuff like the courgettes and the beans, I would just cut a slit in the top and make sure there was enough space for, you know, this, the little sprout to come out. But then most of it's still covered with plastic, which cuts down hugely on weeds. And it's a bit of a more of a pain to water it because you have to make sure the water is like going into the hole and not just on top of the plastic. But then once you water it, the plastic like keeps the water in. So it doesn't dry out as fast either.
And it's obviously, it still drains because it's still, it's such a like nice, long, tall bag, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the only problem with it was that the stuff grew so high, particularly like the beans. And then when the spuds were going, was that it was difficult to steer the boat because you're looking down the length of this boat and then there are all these really tall plants. So I did spend the summer kind of like perched on the side of the boat, looking around the side of these plants to be able to steer with the tiller. So that was the only, I was a bit happy when they finally harvested all the potatoes just so I could see to steer the boat again. And our tomatoes also kept, I think we should have like staked them and tied the stakes to the front of the boat because they were really top heavy and they kept falling into the canal. So we'd have to like jump into the canal after them and like push this like waterlogged jute sack of, with like a meter tall tomato plant back under the boat.
That's perfect. I have this vision, you know, you're like drifting downstream and there's a crowd like watching a Gaelic football match and turn around and just see like these capable hippies you know, just fishing for tomatoes out of the old canal.
Marginally capable, truly capable hippie would have tied their stake to the boat and reinforced it. But I mean, I did like, people loved the garden on the boat. We just got so many comments about it and everyone took pictures of it. And I mean, that's one thing I really love about the community of live aboard houseboaters. And there are maybe 400, I guess, around Ireland, maybe probably more now because it's getting more popular, but they are just really capable. Like they know how to do things and make things. And that's one thing I really love about gardening is like, it's, you actually, once you start growing your own food, you know, you actually do know the process of how this happens and how this is made. And we live most of our lives not knowing that stuff. Like we live in the house that we don't know how to build. We use plumbing and electricity that we don't understand. I'm speaking generally here. We don't understand how to do. We use like internet on machines that we don't understand. And then here's a thing where you actually do learn to understand like where this apple comes from and how this happens and be able to make it yourself, then you, it gives you such insight into how the whole system operates and then all the flaws in the system. You know, like once you start your own garden, like you go to the shop, like a stalk of broccoli should cost like €15, you know, where it is. I'm like, how did I just buy an avocado for 49 cents? Like that's ridiculous. This should be €25 for this. And so you just appreciate like A, how much work goes into it and how much it takes. And then also, like, how broken a system is it that where things can cost so little, particularly like when there is such a great cost to it, whether it's labor cost, whether it's land, water, and fertilizer, and then all the like packing and sending it from New Zealand or Chile or wherever these things come from. It just, it really gives you insight in how broken things are.
Yeah. And it allows you to start fixing them, you know, even in a really small scale. You know, I think that satisfaction also speaks to the sense that you're fixing the problem as well as just enjoying, you know, your tomatoes or your lettuce or whatever. Maybe finally, could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what next? What's going to happen on the houseboat garden next year? What kind of big plans have you cooked up?
Well, I've always wanted to do this, but I think it would be hopeless, is like this the three sisters. It's this like Native American style of farming where you put in corn, the corn grows a foot, then you plant beans, the beans grow up the corn, and then you wait a month after that, and then you plant courgettes, and the courgettes grow along the ground and shade the ground and keep the weeds down, and the beans, you know, do nitrogen into the corn, and the corn lifts the beans to the sun. And they call it the three sisters, and it's just this perfect synchronicity. And I would love to try doing that, but I don't know. I mean, if the beans were a problem to see around on the boats, then a stalk of corn would be just like ludicrous. I don't know how well corn really grows in Ireland either. I'd have to check Nick's book.
If you've learned how to steer the boat without seeing where you're going, then you should just, you know, just drape the boat in all kinds of climbing vegetables and figure that you'll find your way, you know? I mean, it's only one direction, right? When you're going, you know, on the inland waterways of Ireland, there's not too many left turns and stuff, right?
No, that's true. That's true. Particularly with the Grand Canal, it's pretty straight across.
Nice. That is beautiful, Erin. That's a very inspirational note to leave it on. A little bit of kind of connecting in with some of that ancient wisdom, getting back to your, you know, American roots, and continuing that connection back home. So thank you for joining us today. That was a delight. So what do you reckon, Mick? €15 for broccoli?
I mean, it's such a brilliant point, isn't it? Like that our food is too cheap and our veg are too cheap. Like I kind of struggled with carrots for years, growing carrots, because they're kind of little temperamental, you know, and it's hard to get the soil right for carrots to get those perfect carrots. Like, and I always think when you're pulling them out of the ground, that kind of moment of peak carrot, you know, where you've got this like who are these carrots? And if somebody came up to you and said, like, I'll give you 49 cents for them, you'd be like, you'd be chasing them down the road. Like, you might throw them at them maybe to injure them, because it's like these are just precious, you know. So I think we do need to get back to really respecting food producers and the work they do, because it's hard bloody work, let's be honest, at times, you know.
Yeah. And it's a hard one, because you want good food to be accessible to everyone, you know, but at the same time, we need to come at it from the perspective of, you know, paying food producers the right price for what they're providing.
For sure.
So every week we're going to finish off with some practical tips. And this week we're going to go first to our head grower, Richard Mee.
Yeah. So Richard is like, I think he's the real grower here. Like, I have to confess, he's got vast experience growing. I don't know, he'll tell you decades. Has grown commercially for restaurants, grown vegetables. He's been a teacher down in Africa and just knows everything about everything when it comes to growing. He's an amazing. And when I'd be on the TV show doing my stuff, Richard would be off camera somewhere feeding me my lines. You know, he's the real grower, Baz, around these parts.
That's how the sausage is made around here. Cool. Let's go find Richard in the garden. Right, so Richard, as you know, I'm a bit of a beginner grower. I've got a small background.
Aware of that, yeah.
You are, I know. Thank you for your patience. So I've got a small back garden at home. I've got a few raised beds. I've got most of which are now empty. I've harvested pretty much everything I can. I've got a little bit of extra space that I'm always thinking maybe there's another patch to be made into for next year. And
what is under that? What's the ground under at the moment then? In that
grass and, you know, all kinds of dandelions and docks and everything. And I'm always anxious to put some stuff into the soil whenever I can. So have you got some advice for for me.
Yeah, the first thing with the beds where you've been cropping is to ideally have the ground covered with something growing. Bare soil's bad, it's unnatural, and the soil's a thriving ecosystem, the basic food of which is rotting vegetation. So if things are growing, they're growing and rotting in the natural cycle. So to leave soil bare actually leads to it effectively dying to some extent. Mm. And the traditional advice of winter digging and autumn digging actually isn't very good for soil. It's something that goes back to the old Victorian kitchen gardens when there was lots of labour, there's lots of horse manure to resurrect the soil, but there's no need to do it. So in practical terms, what you need to do with your bare areas in your beds, ideally put in a green manure or a crop. Pretty much the only crop you could put in this late on in the year would be garlic. Mm. You could just about get away with some broad beans if you move very quickly. So that's something growing, so the roots are in the soil, keeping it healthy. Or a green manure you can still put in would be cereals of various sorts. So you can buy rye seed, or you can buy oats. Not rolled oats, but whole oats, they could go in. But when you put them in, make sure the birds can't eat them, because they'd clear them for you. Put a bit of net or something over them. Failing that, you can let weeds grow. It seems, you know, we shouldn't be doing that, keep the garden nice and tidy. But weeds don't do much seeding this time of year, so leave your weeds to grow while the soil's still warm, because that's when the bare soil will lose an awful lot of its nutrients and so on. So leave weeds growing or green manure growing into the new year. And then if you want to clear that ground for growing, which I assume is what you want to do, the easiest way is to kill the weeds by depriving them of light or the green manure. So that's covering them with something. I use silage cover here. You can use cardboard if you pin it down really well. We live in a windy island, so lots of rocks or bits of wood or whatever to hold it down. So cardboard will do the job. Some people use carpets, so a little bit worried about those because they often contain various chemicals that would leach into your soil. So I wouldn't personally use them, but old, I don't know anybody has it anymore, old lino will do the job if that still exists. So something to deprive the plants of light. The same technique can be used for your grass and weedy area that you want to grow veg in. Cover it over with something that deprives the plants of light. Do that fairly soon after Christmas. You can work off your Christmas pudding and get out and lay something to lay it with lots and lots of cover, say lots of rocks, wood to keep the wind from blowing it away. And leave that for maybe 2 months, 3 months. The grass will then have rotted away underneath. The worms will have moved it up and down. And then you can come through and dig out the roots of any nasties like scutch grass or docks that are in there. And away you go. Big thing to remember is don't do a traditional autumn winter digging. It's not good for the soil.
Okay, so that is smother, deprive grass from light for a bed next year. Let the weeds grow in the beds that already exist, and don't sow porridge oats into the bed.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for listening. You can get involved and find out more at giy.ie. And to say thanks, you can also get 20% off anything at our online shop by using the discount code GIY20.
And remember that we are a social enterprise, which means all income that we generate goes back into funding the mission to get the world to grow their own food. And we couldn't do this podcast without the support of Rethink Ireland and the Community Foundation for Ireland.
In our next episode, we will be exploring food done right in the community, where we will be looking at an incredible local agriculture project in Holland and meeting another amazing DIYer here in Ireland.
If you want food done right, grow it yourself. Until next time, happy growing.